The opinions and views expressed in this program are not necessarily those of KUCI, the UC Board of Regents, or anyone.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM, Irvine, California.
I'm Nathan Callahan,
and this is Weekly Signals.
At his June 27 debate with Joe Biden, Donald Trump said that some Democratic states allow people to execute babies after they're born, and that every legal scholar wanted Roe v. Wade overturned. Both statements are fantastical lies. Trump also said that the deficit is at its highest level ever, and that the U.S. trade deficit is at its highest level ever. Both of those things happened, but they were during his own administration, the Trump administration. Trump lied that there were no terrorist attacks during his presidency. There were many. Trump said that Biden wants to quadruple people's taxes. This is pure fiction. Then Trump lied that his tax cuts paid for themselves. They have, in fact, added trillions of dollars to the national debt. Trump lied that the U.S. has provided more aid to Ukraine than Europe has, when it's the other way around. Trump was off by close to $100 billion when he named the amount the U.S. has provided to Ukraine. Trump was off by millions when he talked about how many migrants have crossed the border under Biden. Trump falsely claimed that some of Biden's policies, like funding historically black colleges and universities and reducing the price of insulin to $35 a month, were his own accomplishments. He claimed credit for them. Virtually everything Trump said was a lie. He was also confused and scattered in his thoughts. On January 6, Trump said, "We had a great border." To explain how he would combat opioid addiction, Trump veered off into talking points about immigration and said his administration bought the best dog. Trump boasted about acing a cognitive test and that he had just recently won 2 golf club tournaments without mentioning that they were at his own courses and that he's a famed cheater. "To do that, you have to be quite smart, and you have to be able to hit the ball a long way," Trump said. "I can do it." On the environment, Trump said, "Clean water and air. We had it. We had the H2O best numbers ever, and we were using all forms of energy during my 4 years. They gave me the statistic before I walked on stage, actually." Another lie. Trump lies. Everything he says is a lie. Trump also directly accused Biden of his own failings and claimed Biden's own strengths, saying, for example, that Biden, who has enacted the most sweeping legislation of any president since at least Lyndon Johnson, couldn't get anything done while he, Trump, who accomplished only tax cuts for the rich, was more effective. Trump responded to the calling out of his own criminal convictions by saying that Biden could be a convicted felon. "You are a convicted felon, Mr. Trump. You're a felon." It went on and on, and that was the point. This was not a debate. It was Trump using a technique that actually has a formal name, Gish Gallop, although Trump comes by it naturally. It's a rhetorical technique where someone throws out a fast string of lies, non sequiturs, and specious arguments, so many that it is impossible to fact-check or rebut them in the amount of time it took to say them. Trying to figure out how to respond makes the opponent look confused because they don't know where to start grappling with the flood of lies that has just hit them. Since the debate format established that the CNN journalists running the debate did not challenge anything either candidate said, the takeaway of the event was a focus on Biden's age rather than on Trump's ability to tell the truth or form a coherent thought. At the end of the evening, pundits were calling not for Trump, a man liable for sexual assault and business fraud, convicted of 34 felonies under three other indictments, who lied pathologically, to step down, but for Biden to step down because he looked and sounded old. At 81, Biden is indeed old, but that does not distinguish him much from Trump, who is 78, and whose inability to answer any question truthfully should disqualify him from even running for president. He lies about everything. As former Republican operative Stuart Stevens warned, "Don't day trade politics. It's a sucker's game." A guy from Queens out on bail bragged about overturning Roe v. Wade, said in public he didn't have sex with a porn star, defended tax cuts for billionaires, defended January 6th, and called America the worst country in the world. That guy isn't going to win this race. The debate was clear evidence that stage performance has trumped substance in political coverage in our era. 9 years after Trump launched his first campaign, the media continues to let him lie and lie and lie. That was from Heather Cox Richardson's Substack, Letters from an American. Richardson is an American historian, author, and educator. She's a professor of history at Boston College, where she teaches courses on the American Civil War, the Reconstruction Era, the American West, and the Plains Indians. She previously taught history at MIT and the University of Massachusetts Amherst. For more information, go to heathercoxrichardson.substack.com.
This is KUCI 88.9 in Irvine.
The pundit class of American media is suffering from severe memory loss. They're doing exactly what they did in the 2016 presidential race, providing wildly asymmetrical and inflammatory coverage of the one candidate running against Donald Trump. They do this while ignoring something every scholar and critic of journalism knows well, and every journalist should. As Nicole Hannah-Jones put it, "As media, we consistently proclaim that we are just reporting the news, when in fact, we are driving it. What we cover, how we cover it, determines often what Americans think is important and how they perceive these issues. Yet we keep pretending it's not so." According to one journalist's tally, the New York Times has run 192 stories on the subject of Biden's age since the debate, including 50 editorials and 142 news stories. The Washington Post, which has also gone for saturation coverage, published a resignation speech they wrote for him. Not to be outdone, the New Yorker's editor-in-chief declared that Biden not going away would be an act not only of self-delusion, but of national endangerment, and had a staff writer suggest that Democrats should use the never-before-deployed 25th Amendment. And so it goes with what appears to be a journalistic competition to outdo each other in the aggressiveness of the attacks and the unreality of the proposals. It's a dogpile and a panic, and there's no one more unable to understand their own emotional life, biases, and motives than people who are utterly convinced of their own ironclad rationality and objectivity. In other words, most of these pundits. This time around, Trump is not just a celebrity with a lot of sexual assault allegations, bankruptcies, and loopily malicious statements as he was in 2016. He's a convicted criminal who orchestrated a coup attempt to steal an election, both through backroom corruption and public lies and through a violent attack on Congress. The extremist U.S. Supreme Court justices he selected during his last presidential term themselves staged a coup, overthrowing the U.S. Constitution itself and the principle that no one is above the law, officially turning a president into a king or a dictator. Just after legalizing bribery of officials and dismantling the regulatory state by throwing out the Chevron defense. Trump's own former staffers are part of the Heritage Foundation's team planning to implement Project 2025 if he wins, which would finish off our system of government with yet another coup. We are in the process of the Second American Revolution, which will remain bloodless if the left allows it to be, said the foundation's president the other day. This alarms me. So does the behavior of the U.S. mainstream media, which seems more concerned with sabotaging the only thing standing between us and this third coup. Sometimes I wonder if all this coverage is because the media knows how to cover a normal person like a subpar candidate, and they don't know how to cover something as abnormal and unprecedented as the end of the Republic. So far, for the most part, they don't. I get that writing about the monstrosity that is Trump faces the problem that it's not news. He's been a monster spouting lurid nonsense all of his life, but his political crimes are recent, and his free-associating public soliloquies on sharks, batteries, toilets, water flow, and Hannibal Lecter, among other topics, are genuinely demented. He's a racist, a fascist, and a rapist, according to a civil court verdict. We are deciding whether this nation has a future as a more or less democratic republic this November, and on that rides the fate of the Earth when it comes to acting on climate change. If the U.S. falters at this decisive moment in the climate crisis, it'll drag down everyone else's efforts. Under Trump, it will. But the shocking Supreme Court decisions this summer and the looming threat of authoritarianism has gotten little ink and air compared to the hue and cry about Biden's competence. Although the Biden administration seems to have run extremely well for 3.5 years, with a strong cabinet, few scandals, and little turnover, a thriving economy, and some major legislative accomplishments, the narrative the pundits have created suggests we should ignore this record. The main argument against Biden is not that he can't govern. That would be hard to make, given that he seems to have done so for the past years. But that he can't win the election. But candidates do not win elections by themselves. Elections are won, to state the obvious, by how the electorate turns out and votes. The electorate votes based on how they understand the situation and evaluate the candidates. That is, of course, in large part shaped by the media, as Hannah Jones points out. And the media is right now campaigning hard for a Democratic Party loss. The other term for that is a Trump dictatorship. Few things have terrified and horrified me the way this does. That was from Rebecca Solnit's article, Why is the Pundit Class So Desperate to Push Biden Out of the Race?, published in The Guardian, a British daily newspaper founded in 1821. Along with its sister papers, The Observer and The Guardian Weekly, The Guardian is part of the Guardian Media Group, owned by the Scott Trust Limited. The trust was created in 1936 to secure the financial and editorial independence of The Guardian in perpetuity and to safeguard the journalistic freedom and liberal values of The Guardian free from commercial or political interference. For more information, go to theguardian.com. Watching and reading American media, a certain bias becomes immediately evident. Stories proliferate about pundits and a handful of Democrats calling for President Biden to drop out of the race,
but they are almost never balanced by pointing out the massively larger number of Republicans, many now former or never Trump Republicans, but Republicans nonetheless, who are calling for Trump to drop out or be defeated. Why would this be? Why wouldn't the American media at least try to balance their coverage of two flawed candidates? After all, Trump has been disowned by the former head of his own party, Michael Steele, something like half of his own former cabinet members, including his defense and intelligence officials, and even his own former vice president. Shouldn't the GOP calls for Trump to step aside, be replaced, or be defeated from old-line conservative Republicans like Liz Cheney to mainstream Republicans like Steele to organized Republican movements like the Lincoln Project at least be mentioned every time a story is written or a report done on Biden's struggle to hang on to his candidacy? Shouldn't Trump's crimes and anti-American behavior, as well as his own verbal howlers, at least be mentioned whenever Biden's age is criticized? Why aren't they? What's going on here? One proposed answer is that the media is putting their thumb on the scale because they're largely run by billionaires and corporations eager for more tax cuts and afraid of Biden's Bernie-like promise to make them pay their fair share. But the truth is that, with the notorious exceptions of Fox, Sinclair, and X, most media reporting isn't so simplistically driven from the top down. That doesn't mean, however, that one of the biggest problems facing Americans and the fate and future of our democratic republic isn't media bias. It's just a different type of bias, which most people who don't work in the media never consider. I'm not talking about a simple left-right bias, a political preference held by reporters or publishers and editors of the nation's major media outlets. The bias I'm referencing has to do with spectacle. Generations ago, we condescendingly referred to newspapers that emphasized scandal and celebrity intrigue as yellow journalism. The phrase dates back to the 1890s and William Randolph Hearst. From the 1890s until the World War II era, this brand of journalism dominated the American media scene. It took two world wars to push public demand for real news and serious reporting, and an emphasis on fact-based reporting and substance over flash, back into media dominance. They birthed what became the era of Walter Cronkite and Katharine Graham, with honest, credible reporting on everything from Nixon's Watergate crimes to the horrors of the Kennedy assassination and the Vietnam War. Television and radio networks lost money on their news operations, but it was a price they were happy to pay to maintain their otherwise very profitable broadcast licenses. But then something changed. I trace the modern era of yellow journalism to the 1990s, when the nation was transfixed by Ken Starr's and his right-hand man, Brett Kavanaugh's, relentless pornographic four-year-long pursuit of Bill Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky. After Ronald Reagan ended enforcement of the Fairness Doctrine in 1987, radio and TV stations were no longer burdened by the requirement to program in the public interest to maintain their broadcast licenses. Within a year, 1988, all three major TV networks had moved their news divisions, which had universally been losing money in the competition for real news, under the arm of their entertainment divisions, where they remain to this day and have become significant profit centers. Thus was born the modern era of yellow journalism and infotainment, replacing classic issue-based journalism. Rush Limbaugh's 1988 national syndication and Rupert Murdoch's 1996 Fox News set the tone for this era's new yellow journalism, front-loading, as did Hearst back in the day, personality, celebrity, and scandal over the boring details of policy, debate, and the consequences of congressional and presidential decisions. The yellow of this era's yellow journalism more accurately means profitable. And unlike the 1890s, when there were still papers engaging in serious journalism, today's yellow journalism is ubiquitous across the media consumed by the majority of Americans. As a consequence, a Wall Street Journal poll found that 52% of voters claim that Trump has a strong record of accomplishments, but only 40% say the same for Biden. And now the researchers are weighing in, showing how today's yellow journalism has altered our political landscape and led to the rise of the ultimate scandal celebrity personality profit spectacle, Donald Trump and his fascist cult followers. Columbia Journalism Review, the premier watchdog of American news reporting, last year published a scathing indictment of pre-election political coverage in the New York Times and the Washington Post. Nothing has changed in the months since then. If anything, this profit-driven yellow journalism has gotten worse. Because these two newspapers are so widely read and respected, they tend to set the agenda and tone for most other reporting in the United States. And what the review found leading up to the 2022 midterm election was shocking. By the numbers, 408 articles on the front page of the Times during the period the review analyzed, about half, 219, were about domestic politics. A generous interpretation found that just 10 of those stories explained domestic public policy in any detail. That's out of 408 articles, only 10. And only one front-page article in the lead-up to the midterms really leaned into discussion about a policy matter in Congress: Republican efforts to shrink Social Security. Of 393 front-page articles in the Post, 215 were about domestic politics. The research found only 4 stories that discussed any form of policy. The Post had no front-page stories in the months ahead of the midterms on policies that candidates aimed to bring to the fore or legislation they intended to pursue. Instead, articles spec